We'll date the tape. Today is December the 29th, 1996. And we're gathered for a little memorial for John Schrepfer. Greetings, Commander.
Forgive us. There's a little bit of problem here. It's a very, very stressful time. Not just considering passing and passages. It's a stressful time for all of you. Well, all of you try to do everything and more than any human should try to accomplish. And yet, somebody has to do it. And when our stress level moves outward and then is blocked, and it washes back, it almost compounds it. And we have so many various and sundry fragments of problems which need attention and solving that it's very hard to be able to gather up all the loose ends. And then it becomes very difficult to absorb the lessons, see the truth, and experience the presence of God. I wrote a bit this morning that we'll share later. We gather here in this room, a family, if you will, ones who have shared with John. Audrey and Eric can give us some kind of a status report or what the hell happened. John came home. That's what happened. And you're going to find that your heart is going to want to weep for this one, because you understand a passage. You who have family and you've just experienced a holiday, or at least you hope you're speaking with members of your family, and this may be a very good lesson to all of you not to wait too long to patch up differences. Stop pushing them around and don't allow them to push you around. You do not have to give up that in which you believe. To exist, each individual being must come into their own realization in their own way, in their own time. I think it should be recorded here. I'm going to do this for the Constitutional Law Center and those who have to attend the remainder of the interchange regarding John. John died last Monday morning between Sunday and Monday. Audrey, as usual, as you would expect, she and Eric immediately went and had to make some arrangements. Then she began to call family members. She found the wife of the son. Did you ever, Audrey, hear back? We better, if you would speak, please, into the microphone. I think we need to get this business out of the way.
Okay. Well, as John got progressively worse, I realized that I couldn't continue with my job and take care of John the way he needed to be taken care of. So on the 1st of November, I put him in a boarding care here in town that is a little better than most of the ones in town, because there was a registered nurse on duty at all times. And he only lasted there 4 days. He acted up and went on to then he was put in the hospital for evaluation, and and we started looking for a nursing home for him, and finally, just on the Friday before he died, he was taken up to the one there in Porterville, and Eric and I went up the same day to check him in, and we were relieved to find that it was a very nice place, very clean and efficiently run, and the staff seemed very cheerful and friendly. And John had lost 60 pounds while he was in the hospital. He went from 280 to 220. And I was hopeful that their physical therapist would be able to do some good with him, since he didn't have all that weight to carry around. And they were going to give him speech therapy and occupational therapy too. And then he was going to have to be there for maybe 3 months, and then we were hoping to be able to find a place here, you know, closer where his friends could visit him, and you know, more easily. And but now Eric and I went up that day, and the day shift was already gone, so I only got to talk to somebody on the night shift, evening shift, and she said that she'd been told that the aide got John up for his bath that morning, and he was all bathed and dressed and had his shoes on, and he said he wanted his shoes off. And I guess there must be a rule there that you have to wear your shoes, because the aide had to get permission from the nurse. And so the nurse said, okay, and she took his shoes off. And then she said, well, it's time for my break. I'm going to go. And she turned toward the door, and the nurse says, wait a minute, look at him. He's all white and limp. And the aide turned back, and sure enough, apparently John was gone. And now they started CPR, and the paramedics, when they came, continued with the CPR and took him over to the Sierra Hospital there, which was only, what, about 3 blocks away. And but they weren't able to revive him. And one of the nurses I work for, who used to work in an emergency room, said that that looks like the way he went looked like an aortic aneurysm. That, you know, perhaps it could have been a heart attack. There wasn't an autopsy, so, you know, we'll never know for sure. But I think it doesn't matter, because I think John had just decided it was time to go home, and he went home. And
John said to me personally, I am getting out of here. What do you think about that, sir? And what was left? We'll talk about that a little later. John left very easily. He simply announced he was going to go and went. If there was nothing more than what he could see to hold him. And I looked far and wide to try to find anything that I could lay on his lap to look forward to, and I found nothing. I found nothing. Go ahead, please, Audrey.
Well, that's pretty much it. I talked to, first I got the... I talked to Terry, the nephew, and I talked to his brother, who said that he would if we had a service for him, he'd come if it wasn't raining. And when I called his son's home, I got his son's wife, and I told her that I felt that John had regretted that he hadn't kept in close touch with his son, and I felt that. And then I talked to him later, and told him that I felt that Eleanor had done his best to keep John and his son apart. And it was my feeling that it was because she wanted her son to inherit John's money. And he said, well, John was like that before, you know, before Eleanor, that John had pulled away from Johnny. And I could hear the strain in his voice. It was very difficult for him to talk to me. And I just feel sorry for the kid. I hope he's able to work through that. And I think Eleanor owes him big time. I think he did have, he was mistreated. And that's pretty much all I can think of. Eric, do you have anything more to add to the story? For the people on tape land?
Well, when Audrey and I went up to see John on the Friday before his passing, Audrey was walking down the hallway. She just went to wash her hands, and John was in his room, and she just happened to walk by the room, not even looking in. And John perked up and said, "Audrey, I'm in here." And so he was quite conscious and alert of what was going on. And I went in to see John just before he left, and it was interesting because while I was there, I looked at John, and John looked like he was going downhill, and he looked at me, and I asked for the blessings of the light for him. And John says, "Eric," he said, "you know," he says, "I've been in here a while. I think I'm going to check out of here real quick." He says, "I don't want to hang around anymore." So basically, you know, John knew what he was doing, and that's basically what happened. Interesting enough, when John was staying at the board and care here in Tehachapi, I think he's only there about three or four days. And strange enough, he's when he went up to Porterville, he was only there about 3 or 4 days, and he left. But ironically, John was born in Visalia County, and his passing was in Visalia County also. Tulare County. So anyway, that was interesting. So, but the feeling that I got after this was over was that John was in a good place for whatever he was doing, and he's happy where he is. So whatever he's doing, he's joyful. I can attest to that.
That's about all I can think of.
Okay. I wanted to cover these bases because I want all of you, and I want it on the record. I don't care what you think about me. I don't really care what you think about Dorma. But I am going to tell you what I do care about. I care about what happened to John these last years. I'm grateful to every one of you who cared for him and brought him here so he could share. I look over the room and I don't see anybody who could have stood the stress that John Strofer had to bear in these last 4 years. And it wasn't easy before. And every man comes along and makes errors, blunders, acts foolishly. And when you're young, you think, "I don't need these relationships. The kid doesn't need the dad doesn't need the kid. They're a pain in the neck for both." You better look again. Because the ones in this room are the ones that love John enough to see him through his rebirthing. And don't you think for one flimsy, shallow moment that it's death. You walk him in love, in care, into his new life. And whatever ones feel, you have to know that you have to judge actions. How sad that a man lives out these many, many years and only his friends attend his burial. And because of the legal entanglements going on and on and on and on into infinity, we couldn't even have an open funeral, nor could we afford a mortuary service open to the township or his friends from all over. Did he not have friends from all over? No. He had friends. Some of you in the early years here, Al will remember, EJ will remember, there was a mutual friend who came over here to visit John. They had worked together at Fairchild Industries. They had worked in one of the highest aerospace capacities that an engineer could fill. This was a retired admiral from your Navy. In great respect. They shared some time. What were they working on now? Reverse osmosis and the pulse cell pump. Are we going to lose all of them before we make it into our task? Well, maybe we're gaining them. Remains to be seen. John had a lot of lessons to offer. He bore a heavy burden that is not for you to understand. He came back to do that mission. And when he felt he had accomplished all he could, he just said, I'm going home. I just don't need it anymore. And I have to agree, he didn't need it anymore. What would he have to look forward to? For goodness sakes, he's been divorced for 2 years and nothing's been done about his settlement except reopen for them to try to take more. Get everything tied up in litigation. Love John and love the memory. And we'll get on without this kind of interjection later as we talk about the man that was. And you can be sure that Eric spoke well. He can now again be the man he wished to be. For there was no way to serve his mission other than the way he did it while he was here. And there were many lessons in discernment about things versus soul being. And yet even John never could get over the one possession he wanted was his car. And I had to hear about that. You know, and now what are you going to do about my car? I'm not going to do anything about your car, John. It was sold, and you certainly don't need it. But those lawyers may need that income, so let's let it go. Let's leave important things to important things. Well, we'd hope to be able to have some kind of a more public service. But what are you going to do? Get sued for burying the man? What is Audrey to do? Yes, she's a conservator of sorts, a caretaker. Mr. O'Connell is simply a bookkeeper working with a lawyer trying to keep his estate things separate. He was given responsibility for all of their estate settlement. But that's been argued and rebutted and torn down in the Nevada courts. I wonder myself if they will continue to use John Schroffer in their paperwork now that he's gone. They never slowed up. But this is life while you're making other plans for things that you would rather be doing. We did what we felt we could do without calling undue attention. And that was just to go right on with a regular type of gathering so that we could, as a family or circle of friends, and caretaker share a little bit of joy with John at his passage. Don't think John's not here. I want to tell you today a little bit about life, death, and transition. So you may be glad you came. Everybody wonders. Everybody wonders. And what a gentle passing this one had. This was not a gentle man. This was a difficult man. And he used his size, sometimes unwisely. But he was gentle in passing. He had served his sentence. He wanted out. Many of you feel that from time to time. Looks pretty good. I've served my sentence. I'm just going to go. No, you're not. Forget it. You haven't served your mission. And if you call your mission your sentence, then you deserve to suffer a little longer. You don't understand. Passage is nothing in the world but making a transition into a different energy form. And we'll read about it a little bit later because I want it cemented in your mind. You're coming upon times when there will be so many passing that you'll brush wingtips. And I know that your hearts are filled with, well, where's Zita? Where's Rick? Rick was asked to do a little bit of a writing for today. EJ will read it. Rick has taken Zita to Mexico where we can get her some treatment. Where we can get an IV into her and give her stuff that will heal her. And she's already better. Lots better. And through this experience, that clinic will make this a part of their entire healing program. They are amazed. And when we can actually serve up what God has abundantly given you since the beginning of your time, we can utilize things that they can't take away from you unless they strip every olive tree from the surface of your globe. There are things, but they're not available to you. And they are desperately trying to get the colloids off the market before anybody discovers they work. And already, you're dealing with some interesting phenomenon. 15 years, there have been zinc lozenges around. Now, they've come to wonder, how is it that it works? Well, it's zinc. And the cold virus is latched on to its head and its body with a zinc molecule. So if you can match that frequency, you can blow out that zinc molecule. If you can get it a little bit higher, you shatter it. And if you don't have them lingering along and along and along, producing the side effects of an infection, you can get over it. With zinc, you're not going to be able to get over it as rapidly as if you had titanium lozenges. But you've got to have that in a colloid, and it has to work from the inside out. Or it's damaging to you. So we can only offer what we are allowed to offer. But we also need to make these relationships. This time, Rick and Zita went straight to Mexico. And those people are so grateful that they will come in on their holidays to work with Zita. And that is a compliment to all of you. Death is simply a transition. And what John would smile about is how different it is from what you anticipate. There's no more attachment to that pile of flesh. But before there were any firm appointments with whether or not we're going to enter in the earth or enter in an urn, I'm going to repeat something. Do not make these hasty decisions and beware of those such as the Israelites who will burn the body or bury the body within 24 hours. People have been known to get up off of their slab in cold storage and walk out of a mortuary. And these are not the angels. These are living beings. So give yourself a couple of days, if you don't mind, and your family will put up with you. If you can give 3 days, then you know that deterioration of the body itself is no longer suitable for life form, life ability, capability. And you don't make a transition to come back into a less worthy body unless you are really trying to overcome some handicap as a lesson to self or others around. So always give 3 days. And then it doesn't matter. So what would we decide to do? Doesn't matter. You understand? In fact, my preference became one of cremation. Does anybody want to really hear what a low-down son of a bitch I am? Thank you. I'm tired of you trying to poke all of us up on pedestals somewhere. I want that body in ashes in an urn, and one day I want it presented to John Jr. And they can scatter it wherever they want. But just to get rid of John today is not going to happen. And he can live in his urn on our mantle in any home of anyone in this room. Or he can sit right there on the table. I don't want him out of the way so that the family can just shake their head and never again until their own transition have to think about it. Because one day, to that son, it will be priceless. Priceless. Because no man wants to make transition without having come to some justification with his parents. Honor thy father and mother, no matter who or what they are. Because someday you will confront that. Now, what happens in this period of, we'll call it the waiting? It isn't null time. It isn't void time yet. We're not in voidance yet. And what you don't understand is that there is a rest time, a transition time. You misspeak. There are no angels of death. There are angels of life. There are angels of darkness. And there are angels of transition. There is no such thing anywhere in the universe recognized as what you call death. None. Nothing. Oh, but when the body ceases to have soul and mind dies, brain death, you're wrong, Commander, because cells stop growing. Oh? Wrong. As long as there are microorganisms in the universe, only the energy form and action changes. into one of disintegration instead of integration. The desire is always for every part to return to that which it was. So even after you have consumed or changed, and cremation does that rapidly, you reduce it to its component parts. The fluids will evaporate into their gaseous state. The mineral content will come down into its ashen state or its decayed state. All those little viruses and retroviruses and bacteria will either deteriorate, move out, perish, or they will go dormant with the removal of life fluid. But what happens to soul? That's what we're interested in. You guys get stuck with a body that he couldn't care less about now, especially now. It was getting to be a terrible bother to him then. Now, he doesn't have to worry about that anymore except to be amused at what you're doing. Let's talk about transition. The guides, that angel that you want the call of death, that I call transition. No soul makes that journey alone. Unfortunately, in total denial, the angels that accompany are from the dark side. There aren't too awfully many souled beings who get to that point of transition without coming into realization that as they make their passage, they're really asking for God. Ones will talk about Christmas Day. Why? Why did so many unlikely things happen that saved a mother and two babies, two children? Well, the moment that she began to lose control of that car, she called on God so fast it was just natural. Oh, God, help me. And the proper angels are around to pitch in. Life is like that. If you call on God, God will respond. But it's pretty darn bleary out there sometimes because no one else is hearing. No one else is hearing the call. So you need some experiences like this. Those ones experiencing need these expressions of love and truth and response. And they need follow-on, follow-up. Because you don't know what's going on with anyone else's life that you touch. And there was some pretty serious touchy-goey going on there. That lady made her trek to the other side at least twice. And she won't forget that. There is a period of time when the soul departs, and for those 3 days, it will not leave the area. It's observing, it's sorting, it is confronting, it's doing all its data check work, it's making its confrontation with itself. It is, in most instances, choosing whether it will go on or will it come back. Where is its service? Because it is recognized on the other side of that veil that consciousness, as in mortal consciousness, changes. So a lot of realization in consciousness has to take place immediately. And there are sequences of experiences in that soul form that has to be attended. There's a matter of placement. To what level have you grown to experience within an invisible environment? I'm not talking about ascend. You see, the soul always knows how to ascend. You know, most of you don't see John here. But John's here. He certainly knew how to ascend, and he knows how to descend. Of all the things John wouldn't miss was his own party. I mean, don't be silly. Unfortunately, he wants to know who cared and who did not. You still have that observation factor where you can't do anything but cling to the energies being sent forth from the ones he knows. Any of you who think that you're going to go lay somebody in a grave and then you're going to go visit and you're going to go leave flowers annually on the death day, you're silly. You're doing that for yourself. Or for any you're impressing. I don't care which. It doesn't mean that going down there isn't a method of communication with this energy. It is like calling this energy back to share a moment in memory. Remember, it's all over. It's all over for you too. You can only, the rest of your days, if you thought of nothing else but John, it's nothing but a memory. Gone. So you want to hold in memory those things that touched you of the departed. And frankly, you want to hold in memory both the negative and the positive of the experiences. But you forgive the negative, learn from it, adjust your own experience according to what you can learn from it. Appreciate the lesson learned from it. And then remember the positive. Don't dwell on the nasties. Dwell on the light. Because you don't know that other's contract. And that one comes into knowing immediately on his passage of his contract, his purpose, and he confronts God. That doesn't mean he moves to the right hand of God to forever co-create. It means you confront and you pull up all that data of all your experiences and you can check off, did I pay off some of this, what you want to call karma? But you don't know what karma is. And you can get rid of karma by announcing that you're no longer going to accept that load that somebody else, probably a good psychic, told you you owed somebody. And I would interrupt with a good story about John Srofer right here. He lived for many years thinking hell was his lot. Now, guess what? Some nice psychic friend of his told him, it's your karma. Eleanor is your karma. You were in a past life together and you mistreated her and abused her and now you're going to pay. And he did. Don't listen to your friendly soothsayer. If somebody tells you you are a perfect match, God made you as twin flames, bullshit. Thank you. sounds nice, and maybe there is a sense of realization that you fit, you seem to fit, but to pronounce karma or a lifetime of bliss together, it won't work. Because the first time that you want to cop out, you're going to say, oh my goodness, so-and-so told me we were meant for each other, darling. What's the matter with us? What is the matter with you? He said, what's your hurry? What is your hurry? Can you not become friends and love for what it means before you start making these infernal contractual arrangements on what you call earth? Because the contract is cemented in the heart. It doesn't matter what you put on a piece of paper. And this is true of our relationships right this minute, ongoing with South Africa, Greece, all around your globe. If you cannot trust a man by a handshake, or this is my word, you don't have anything upon which to base anything except some income for some attorneys later. And I hate to be hard because Gene is so close to the attorney relationship that I feel like I'm bashing him every time I say that. But only Gene wants his ticket back. That's so he can practice in behalf of you ones in front of a justice, or an injustice, as the case may be. At any rate, the veil is crossed. And there is a period of rearrangement of direction. There is no longer, and almost every soul will try to reach back through to communicate. And especially a new soul can only, at the most, make connection with a mind wave of someone else. Because when the physical hand doesn't come up, it's not going to reach out there and shake yours. And there is a period of time where almost all who make that passage have to have their guides because they do not know they are now dead in flesh.